tilted to cover one eye, though the other blazed with rough blue flame. He was chatting with one of the nearby suits of armor, one of which stepped forward and did a little pirouette as Kai watched. Benson angled his fiery eye toward Kai and frowned. Kai was never clear on how he did that, without lips. The skeleton said something, adjusting his hat as he did, but Kai couldn't hear it. Steel thundered through his veins. When his vision returned, he launched himself at the gate. The force of his jump tore the soil where he stood, and he hurtled through the air. Links of black chain whipped up to meet him, but Kai was prepared. He twisted in midair, meeting the chains with Mithra's blade. The chain wrapped around Kai's sword, and the knife pulled tight. Mithra was wrenched from Kai's grasp. Even though he had only had the Dragon's Fang back for less than an hour, Kai already felt the pang of loss. Still, the sword was not his first priority. He had to reach the gate. Kai fell, feet first, toward the open portal. Then the eldest let out a low, keening whistle. Two Nai emerged from the gate in a river of flowing black cloth. Their hoods flared with light the color of the moon. They blurred forward, moving too fast for Kai to follow. The Nai leaped into the air, each one grabbing one of Kai's arms. Kai punched one of them away, but the second pulled him straight down to the ground. He slammed into the grass hard enough to send a tremor running through the soil, though the Nai fell lightly enough. With so much steel running through him, Kai barely felt the impact. The gate had continued to shrink, but Kai could still fit himself through it. He was only a foot away. He threw himself forward. Nai flowed out from Valenhall like a black river. Kai's face smacked into a wall of black cloth. Two Nai grabbed his feet, two his arms, trying to twist his hands behind his back. Others caught him up under the ribs or by the neck, twisting their chains around him. But he had been defeating Nai in combat since he was a child, and he did not intend to go easily. He used raw strength to force his arms back around into position, and called knives from the Valenhall armory. He stabbed one of the Nai in the heart, thrusting his second knife into another Nai's hood. They took his knives away, but he kept calling weapons, struggling and knocking Nai away like a child swatting bees. His steel ran out. Kai sagged, the sudden weakness running through his body, and the black robes had him trussed and tied in seconds. He felt as though they had wrapped him in a cocoon of cold, biting black chains. Craning his neck, Kai could barely see the gate still shrinking. If he wanted to escape now, he would have to crawl through. If only Kayla were here. He had never expected to die without one of his lovely little ones at his side. The wall of Nai parted, and their eldest stepped through. He kept one of his arms behind his back, though in the other he held Mithra. His pace-long sleeve fell all the way to the ground. The eldest twisted his sword to catch the light. "Beautiful," he whispered. "Truly the master's finest work. He will lead Valenhall to glory once again, once he has this back." Kai cried out, but it wasn't enough to stop the eldest from turning and hurling the dragon's fang at the tree. The gold and silver sword flashed as it spun, end over end, before stabbing itself into the center of the tree. It landed inside the scar, in the long crack that ran through the tree's flesh. Kai only thought he had heard the tree scream before. This time, it howled, and the earth buckled under its fury. Even some of the Nai were tossed from their feet. Kai was lifted off the ground and slammed back down, the chains cutting into his skin, but he barely noticed. The agony of the hanging tree tore at his mind, shredding his thoughts like knives through his brain. The tree's scream was silent, but he felt it, like red-hot ants running in his blood. Then, the scream stopped. At the center of Latari Forest, the hanging tree died. For a moment there was only silence. No living thing in the entire forest made a sound. Each of the Nai turned their empty hood to face the pile of wood that had once been a tree for Magnaris. Kai started to wonder if he could, perhaps, wriggle free while their attention was elsewhere. If he stayed where he was, he would surely die. Then, a crack like a lightning strike, the scarlet tree split completely down the middle, and Mithra tumbled free to land on the grass. Each half of the blood-red trunk split, falling away from each other. A man rose from the earth beneath the broken tree. His skin was covered by 25 years' worth of mud and grime. He stood, brushing a hand over his bald head, scraping dirt from his eyes. His shirt crumbled off as he stood, though enough of his pants remained to account for decency. "It's amazing," Kai thought, "the things you notice before you die." The man stepped forward, out of the remains of the tree. The eldest went to one knee in front of him, and the Nai all followed suit as one, kneeling before their leader. He continued brushing the dust from his skin, revealing black marks. Black marks like tattoos, like the shadows left by chains, like the marks on Kai's own arms. Only, on this man, the shadow chains traveled up his arms, spiraling around his shoulders, wrapping around his torso, twisting around his legs. Links of chain wound around his neck, traveling up his face in a bizarre mask, covering his head like hair. The Wanderer opened his eyes, and they were the same that had haunted Kai's nightmares for half his life. They had no whites, only darkness all around. His irises were a pure metallic silver, like the steel of a dragon's fang. Valin, the Wanderer, the incarnation of Valinhal, reached down and picked up his sword.
"Kanya Ka, my friend," Valin said. The voice was the same as Kai remembered from his childhood, still warm and firm at the same time. The eldest stood, but he kept his hood bowed.
"It has been too long, master."
Valin nodded, smiling a little. "It has. I have spent far too many years dreaming, it seems." Then he pointed to Kai with Mithra's tip. "Let him go." The eldest hesitated, but not the other Nai. They swarmed over Kai in a flutter of cloth and blurred motion, and when they withdrew, not a link of chain remained. The sensation left Kai feeling dizzy. It felt something like having his clothes torn off by a hurricane. Kai scrambled to his feet, still awash in too many emotions to name. He was terrified for his life, which was as it should be, but he had not expected to feel so glad to see his mentor again. And he thought he had buried his rage, his hunger for vengeance at the one who had killed his brothers and sisters. He had thought that particular emotion conquered years before, but here it was, resurrected with the father who had slaughtered so many of his adopted children. Valin levered Mithra up and leaned it against his shoulder in a gesture so familiar that it brought an ache to Kai's heart. He gave Kai a crooked grin. "You're looking old, Kai. How long has it been?"
"Almost 25 years, Kai whispered.
Valin's black and silver eyes widened. "Wow! In that case, you're looking good. How goes the war against Damasca? I'm sure you guys had it rough without me around."
Kai's throat went dry. "Zacharet the Sixth remains on the throne."
"The Sixth? I remember the Fifth." Confusion darkened Valin's features, but then he brightened. "Hold on, you mean the one who sealed me here, the Ragnaros traveler with the red eye?" Kai nodded. "I admit, Kai, I'm a little hurt. 25 years and you still haven't avenged me. I would have thought Indiriel, at least."
Valin trailed off, and he stared into the distance, lost in the past.
"No, wait. Indiriel, he fought me. He sealed me."
Valin's face contorted with rage.
"He stood with the Damascans. Even Indiriel, of all people. I thought he would be with me to the last."
Around Valin, the grass began to shrivel and curl until it looked like a tightly woven carpet of green. In reality, Kai knew, it was a carpet. Behind the incarnation, the brown slivers of the dead hanging tree merged, flowing into one another until they wove into a rough, splintery, wicker-back chair. Incarnations warped the world around them, reforming reality, twisting it. The longer they stayed in one place, the more the world would transform in the image of the incarnation's territory. In this case, he was turning this world into Valinhal simply by standing there. Kai glanced back over his shoulder at the shrinking gate. His heart sank.
It was only as big across as his head. He would never be able to squeeze through. There were other ways, but he needed Valen distracted. The eldest cleared his throat.
Pardon, master. Indiriel was not the only one to oppose you that day.
His hood turned to face Kai. Valen shook his head like a dog shaking off water. No, Kai stood with me. He fought Indiriel. I remember that. But wait, no, he was there. Kai, you were there. You were there when they sealed me.
At the end, Valen's voice rose, and an inhuman ring entered his voice, like steel on steel.
I stood with you until the end, Kai said quietly. But while I fought Indiriel, to keep him from killing you, you carved your way through Valenhall. 8 children you raised and murdered.
His voice broke. Their faces swam in front of him even now. Children raised as his brothers and sisters. Murdered by the man they called their father.
Valen shook his head, smiling patiently.
No, Kai, no. I tested them. You have to earn your power in Valenhall. It's the law of our world. Denner and Catherine passed my test, so I had them healed. They are my true children, like you and Indiriel. The others, well, I spared them a worse death.
The old familiar rage rose up in Kai again, and he met his mentor's nightmare eyes.
You lost control. You've become an incarnation, Valen. You're a monster.
Valen met Kai's eyes for a moment longer, and then he nodded.
I'm sorry you feel that way, Kai. You were almost worthy to succeed me.
Something occurred to him, and he looked down at Mithra.
As a matter of fact, you earned this, didn't you?
He flipped the sword over to Kai. It spun through the air and landed point down, stabbing into the grass. Valen held out a hand, and an enormous steel claymore flashed into his grip.
I need that sword, Kai, he said, his tone matter-of-fact. But I'm no thief. If I want it, I have to earn it back.
Behind him, a sapling turned into a coat rack. Kai wrapped his hand around Mithra's hilt, but he didn't pull it out. His steel had not quite recovered, while Valen had his full strength to draw upon. If they fought now, Kai would die instantly. But what choice did he have? Mentally, he focused on the image of the little quicksilver vial that he had once received from Benson. He pictured its shape, its color, the feel of the cold power rushing along his bones. He dove deeper. He saw Benson again, sitting on his throne in Valenhall's blue-lit basement. The skeleton leaned forward.
Your steel's run out, Kai. Nothing I can do to help that.
The skeleton's blue flame eye narrowed, as though he were focusing on something.
Hang on. What's got a hold of you?
The Wanderer, Kai sent.
He pushed his thoughts forward, concentrating on Benson as he always had on his dolls. The steel skeleton's eye widened.
I'll see what I can do, kid. Try to hold on.
The vision of the basement blew apart, replaced by the Latari clearing. The knife stood aside, leaving Valen and Kai enough room to swing their huge blades. Valen stood, his chain-marked body angled and waiting for Kai.
Well, Kai, Valen said, I've been here 25 years. I'm not waiting another.
Steel flooded into Kai in a rushing waterfall of ice, and he ran forward. On the way, he called every power he thought would help. The stone amulet armoring his skin. The bottle of liquid gold, flooding cheery warmth through his body and lending him new vitality. The iron scroll, granting him more knowledge of combat and tactics than he could have earned in one lifetime. They blasted through him in a river of strength and power, and he channeled it all into his attacks. Pale blue light flickered through Valen's skin, as he called one of the powers to which Kai did not have access, Essence of the Nigh. Valen stepped to one side, and Kai's strike missed him by a hair's breadth. Kai turned his stroke into a stab, which Valen batted aside with his own blade. He let out a blistering 3-part combination, but Valen turned every attack. Once, he slapped Mithra aside with the palm of his hand.
Kai finished with a downward stroke of his dragon's fang, putting all his steel strength into the blow. Valin caught the blow on his own sword and held it off with one hand. With every bit of strength he could muster or call, Kai pushed his sword down toward Valin's head. But, one-handed, the Valinhall incarnation was still stronger. Valin pushed Kai's blade aside.
"You're not bad, Kai," Valin said. "But you don't have the full power of Valinhall.
My turn." Then he attacked. Kai could barely see the blows, let alone turn them aside. He met a few using nothing more than his knowledge of Valin's habits and patterns, and some of the other strikes didn't land firmly enough to penetrate his stone-hard skin. With his dolls, maybe he could have countered Valin's assault. The Valinhall incarnation had almost unlimited strength, speed, and endurance, but Otoku or Gloria could have given him the edge he needed to dodge. Without their advice, he wasn't fast enough. Valin drew a line of blood down Kai's cheek, his right arm, his hip, and his left leg. Kai ignored the pain, drawing on the power of the ice dagger from the winter garden. It numbed the wounds, kept him fighting, even as his other powers kept him on his feet. Finally, one of Valin's blows met Mithra near the hilt. Kai's palms rang as though he had held them against a struck bell, and the dragon's fang fell to the grass. Valin scooped up his sword. He sighed in contentment. "Much better," he said. The claymore vanished. Kai backed up a few steps, as his former master got the feel of his old sword. He only had one power left in his arsenal that might be of any use to him at all. He continued creeping backwards, his eyes fixed on Valin. The wanderer turned his metallic eyes to Kai. "You have done well, Kai. I am proud to call you my student. But you might warn the Damascans before I can finish what I started." He raised Mithra's silver and gold blade.
"Goodbye," Valin said.
Kai reached into Valinhall and called the Black Gauntlet. Valin rushed forward in a blur of flashing steel, but the dark metal gauntlet shimmered as it vanished from Valinhall and appeared on Kai's left hand. It was heavy, spiked, and tipped on each finger with claws, not something you would normally wear when fighting. The knowledge of the Iron Scroll warned Kai that Valin would attack his neck, so he spun around as he dropped to one knee. Mithra sliced through the air above him. Kai reached up with his left hand, gripping the Valinhall gate with his taloned fingers. The portal was now only the size of a grape. Kai drew the gauntlet down, tearing a ragged hole in the world. The Black Gauntlet was difficult and time-consuming to earn, but it was the Valinhall Gate Crawler, a device that could tear closing or recently closed gates back open. It was the only way Kai knew of to follow a traveler into a foreign territory, but he had never used it to open his own. In theory, it should work the same way. And now he had proved that theory to himself. He knelt before a Valinhall gate, full-sized, if a bit more ragged around the edges than usual. Kai threw himself into the entry hall, just as Valin's sword came down again. He felt a line of fire against his back, but he cleared the border. Valin stood at the edge of the gate, staring into the territory he had created.
"Come on in, master," Kai taunted. "I'm wide open."
He brushed white hair out of his eyes and was startled to find the hair warm and sticky with blood. Valin smiled a little, but he pulled Mithra back. There was a sound like a distant horn, and the blade began to vibrate as though Kai saw the sword through a heat haze.
"Sorry, Kai," Valin said. "I'll come home someday. But until then, I've got work to do."
He swept the shivering dragon's fang across the gate, and the gate blew away like dandelion fluff in a high wind. Kai smiled to himself.
"I won," he thought. "I survived."
Then he passed out in a pool of his own blood. When Adrienne Lamarcus Diasis felt the silent scream shudder through the stone of her Belcalum home, she stood from her breakfast and rushed out the doors. Black skirts swished around her ankles as she walked. She would wear no other color until she had finished mourning her husband, which would not be until she could have justice for his death. Petrus met her outside the dining hall doors. The pudgy, balding Naraka traveler waved his one remaining arm in a panic.
"We need to get out of here, my lady. 7 stones, I don't know why we're not dead already."
Adrienne kept walking, forcing Petrus to keep up.
"Is it free?" she asked.
She had to prepare for the worst. The aging traveler shrugged, which was not the most comforting thing he could have done.
"I certainly haven't examined the tree myself," Petrus said. "But I would say no, the Naraka incarnation is not free. If it was, I suspect we would be burning to death right now."
She nodded, processing the information. On the move, Adrienne signaled a nearby guard.
"Evacuate the house," she told him. "I want everyone who isn't a traveler out of here 5 minutes ago."
The soldier saluted and started to run off, but she grabbed him by the elbow before he could move.
"On second thought, take it a step further. Evacuate this whole quarter of the city. Tell the captain he's authorized to use whatever force he feels is necessary. I will be there to supervise the operation as soon as I can."
The guard let nothing show in his face, which Adrienne considered a blessing. He simply gave her another salute and ran off to carry out his orders. Since Malachi's death, too many had felt free to tell her exactly what they thought of her commands. Evacuating an entire quarter of the city would be a logistical nightmare, and she doubted it would be possible in anything less than a full day. But, should the worst happen, some of her citizens would have a better chance to escape. Petrus was already out of breath from keeping up with her, but he managed an approving nod.
"Good, my lady, very, very good. There's nothing more we can do here."
Adrienne gave him her most disarming smile without slowing her pace.
"What are you talking about, Petrus? We're going down to check on the tree. If that incarnation breaks out, he'll have to go through us first."
She was no traveler, and she barely had an inkling of the kind of power that one of the incarnations wielded. But she would slow it down with her body if necessary. Malachi would have given his life to stop the incarnation from reaching Belcalem. In his memory, she could do no less. Overlord Lysander Tyrannus had sent his Sauron tribe sparrows to check on the tree the instant he felt the distortion. As an Avernus traveler, he had a deep bond with his birds, but also utmost confidence in their abilities. If any flock could survive an encounter with the Ragnaros tree, it would be his. Lysander's tree rested in the center of a forest glade, next to a creek, inside a huge marble mausoleum that had been constructed for exactly this purpose. He had ordered the doors opened a crack, enough to send his tiny birds inside, but in that instant he had nearly been skewered by thorny tendrils the color of blood. His sparrows had only made it inside, thanks to the natural agility of the Sauron. He could feel them fluttering against the doors now, and he signaled his guards to haul the doors back open. They did, though it took 4 men. The flock of brown-gold sparrows swept out of the marble doors in a cloud, crimson branches snapping at their tail feathers. The guards staggered back, letting the doors slam shut. They closed on some of the tree's vines, cutting them in half. Lengths of supple red wood fell to the ground, squirming like blood-colored worms. The Sauron whirled around Lysander's head, sharing with him the squeaky, chirping thoughts of their flock mind.
"Tree weak,"
they sent.
"Needs time. Time to heal. Needs feeding. Next year. Hungry. Weak. Broken. Needs time."
Lysander felt himself smile. The tree would not have the time it needed to recover. He and His Highness Talos, the last remaining real Damascan heir, would see to that. They would rule over the world as it was meant to be. He had foreseen it. Deborah was miles away when her tree screamed, but she felt it in the rock. Through her bare feet pressed to the rocky ground, she felt the earth's pain and fury as the crimson roots of Ragnaros struggled to contain the incarnation of Ornheim. It wasn't breaking free, not yet, but it was awake. It was aware, as it had not been in the 3 centuries since it was sealed beneath the earth. She rose to her feet, feeling the faintest creaking of joints. She wasn't as young as she used to be, but she'd let Naraka take her before she gave in to age. She stood, stretching her aching back, and surveyed the cavern. Stalactites hung many paces overhead, leaving enough room for a two-story house. The broad floor, wide enough to host a grand ball, was covered in half-finished golems. Obsidian wolves with three emerald eyes waited, inanimate, as a young Ornheim initiate shaped its hind legs. Huge, hulking granite guardians crouched against the wall, awaiting the topaz heartstones that would bring them to life. Sleek, angular assassins of flint and shale prowled restlessly, ruby heartstones gleaming in the dim light. Each golem required weeks of delicate care and preparation, but that was the way of Ornheim. Patience, care, and endurance yielded rewards. Soon, their golem army would shatter the walls of Enosh, assuming that the Ornheim incarnation did not break free and kill them all. Ornheim travelers paced up and down the rows of golems, making last-minute checks and attending to the business of creating Damascus' golem army. Or at least, they had been attending to business a moment ago. But they had all felt the warning in the earth at the same time, and they all looked to her, their overlord, for orders. Overlord Deborah kept herself from smiling, as she habitually kept most expressions off her face, but she felt it on the inside. This was why Ornheim travelers were so much more useful than those of other territories. They did not panic or flail around or look for further confirmation of what they already knew. They simply, patiently, diligently awaited orders. Her heart swelled with pride, but she pushed the feeling back. She had work to do. Deborah signaled two of the travelers nearest her. Urien, Danelle, get back to Tarkanus. Put the tree on full lockdown. If anything tries to get in or out, I want them to have to dig through two mountains and half a dozen golems. Yes, Overlord, they said in unison, and jogged off to open their gates. Everyone else, back to work. Double time. We need to finish this battalion as soon as we can, then get back to Tarkanus ourselves. If the incarnation breaks free, we should be there to face it. Several travelers shouted their assent and returned to work, but Janira stepped up close, doubt plain on her face. She had advised Deborah for years, as her mother had counseled Deborah's. As usual, she wore a net of diamonds in her braided hair. "Pardon me, Overlord," Janira said, "but shouldn't we inform the king?" Deborah shook her head, thinking about the Overlord of Cana. "Trust me, Janira. The king already knows." Indiriel sprinted through the halls of the royal palace in Cana, black cloak flowing behind him. There were two guards on the door to the king's private library, both Tartarus travelers, and normally they would have challenged him about his purpose if they saw him trying to enter. That was a good policy, and one he encouraged. No one, not even him, should be able to reach the king without royal permission. But today he didn't have time for the usual rules. He flew down the hallway with the clear intention to run through anything in his way. The two Tartarus travelers noticed. They got out of his way. Indiriel slammed through the library doors to find King Zachareth seated at a desk, his sleeves rolled up, elbow deep in books, maps, and old scrolls. He looked up, surprise evident on his face. "Indiriel, what's wrong?" Indiriel didn't bother bowing. He didn't have time. "The tenth tree is broken," he said. "Valen is free." Zachareth stared for a moment, and his face tightened in an expression of cold anger. He slammed his hand flat against the desk. "Why now, of all times?" he demanded. "The Maker's reward for our clean living," Indiriel responded dryly. Zachareth shook his head, tearing a gate to the crimson vault open behind him. The portal itself was lined in bright red light, though it opened on a rough stone cave. A pair of silver doors, carved with the image of a one-eyed king long dead, led into the vault proper. The entire scene was lit only by a pair of unnatural scarlet torches. Zachareth walked through the gate, motioning Indiriel to come along behind him. "Follow me," the king said wearily. "Let's get to work." Chapter 5. The Rising Sun. Alan held up the golden breastplate and admired the way it gleamed in the afternoon sunlight.
The Grandmasters had mined the ore from Ornheim and forged the armor in Tartarus, so that it looked like gold, but was much harder and lighter. It even had the symbol of Elysia etched in the center, a winged sword, point down, with a rising sun in the background. Alan thought the armor would make him look regal, like a warrior king from the stories. But first, he had to put it on.
Excuse me, the armorer said from somewhere around Alan's feet. I'm sorry, sir, but could you please put the breastplate back?
Just a moment, Alan said. He turned the plate so it best caught a ray of sunshine through the high windows, gleaming like a fallen star.
I quite understand, sir, but please, it's on my head.
Startled, Alan pulled the armor up. The armorer, who had been adjusting one of the many straps on Alan's golden boots, was now crouched on the floor, peering up. Without even noticing, Alan had been resting the sheet of metal on the back of the man's skull. Alan flushed with shame and moved the plate aside.
My apologies, Master Farin. I was careless.
Farin, the most highly regarded armorer in the city of Enosh, chuckled nervously.
Not at all, Eliadel, not at all. As soon as I am finished fitting the greaves, we will attach the breastplate. Do not worry. You will look radiant for the celebration this afternoon.
Alan looked over at the full-size mirror, which easily held the largest amount of smooth mirrored glass he had ever seen. From the waist down, he looked magnificent, with gold-plated armor covering him from hips to toes. His shoulders and arms were covered in gold as well, and his hands in golden gauntlets, but his midsection was a mass of chain mail and leather straps. For reasons he didn't understand, the chest and back were assembled last. Master Farin had assured him that the suit he wore was a simplified version of the usual plate armor, and was much easier to don and remove. He had also claimed that this suit, being made from rare ingredients and techniques not of this world, was lighter, stronger, and more flexible as well. Alan felt strong enough wearing the armor, but sweat ran down. The suit he wore was a simplified version of the usual plate armor, and was much easier to don and remove. He had also claimed that this suit, being made from rare ingredients and techniques not of this world, was lighter, stronger, and more flexible as well. Alan felt strong enough wearing the armor, but sweat ran down his back, and he wondered if he would be able to close his gauntleted fingers enough to lift the sword. He couldn't even put the suit on or take it off by himself. If this was better than what real knights had worn into battle, back when plate armor was the fashion, then he was glad he was not a knight. Alan wasn't sure why the people of Enosh usually used this room of the Grandmaster's palace, but it was round and very high. Tall windows high up on the walls let in the sunlight, and the double doors were at least 10 paces tall. Other than the mirror, those were the room's only features. Without warning, the two tall doors opened, and Grandmaster Naraka hobbled inside. Grandmaster Naraka had left her birth name behind decades ago, and she was easily the oldest person Alan had ever met. Since coming to Enosh, Alan had heard rumors that Grandmaster Naraka was over 100 years old. Looking at her hunched and shriveled form, he had no reason to doubt it. She wore a pair of glasses perched on her nose, with thick red lenses so dark they were almost black. Alan had occasionally wondered if she was blind, and wore such dark glasses because she couldn't see. But he couldn't imagine any disability severe enough that the Grandmaster would bow to it.
Eliadel, the Grandmaster croaked. She bowed her head a fraction. How do you like your armor?
I'm sure it will look great at the celebration, Grandmaster, he said. He meant it, but he was afraid he might also trip over his own boots and fall on his face in front of the entire population of Enosh.
Grandmaster Naraka snorted.
Oh, you'll look good, and maybe this armor will stop you from getting yourself killed next time you leave the city.
Alan winced at the thought. Only this morning had Grandmaster Asphodel allowed him to remove his bandages, pronouncing him healthy enough so long as he doesn't toss himself face first into a furnace. Again. She had waddled off in a huff, muttering about children. Alan had no wish to be healed by her a second time.
I have learned my lesson, Grandmaster, Alan said humbly. I will not act so rashly again.
Not unless he had to.
Naraka waved a hand at him. That's neither here nor there, boy. Do you remember what to say this afternoon?
Master Farin pressed the breastplate against Alan's chest. "I will wave to the people, and I will demonstrate the power of Elysia," Alan recited. "I will tell the people how Enosh needs to be strong, and that together we can bring Damascus' unnatural blight to an end. I will remind them how we defeated Overlord Malachi."
"You," Grandmaster Naraka corrected.
For a moment, Alan didn't understand what she meant. Master Farin tugged the straps on his armor so abruptly that he almost fell over.
"You will remind them how you overcame Overlord Malachi," the Grandmaster said. "Not we. You were the one who killed the Overlord."
"That's true, but Simon was there first," Alan pointed out. Master Farin had secured the breastplate and had moved around to his back. "Without him, Leah and I would never have escaped with our lives."
"You give Simon too much credit," Grandmaster Naraka said dismissively. "If he truly battled the Overlord, why were the both of them still alive after the fight, Tell me that. I find it more likely that he and Malachi came to some sort of an arrangement."
"Not Simon," Alan said firmly. "The Endros traveler, Cormac, killed his mother. He hates Damascus as much as I do." Then again, Simon had begged Alan not to kill the Overlord, but that didn't mean anything. He had wanted to spare Malachi's children the sight of their father being executed. It had probably made him remember his own past, and Alan couldn't blame him for that.
"I hope that is so," Grandmaster Naraka said. "Damascus is true evil. Their human sacrifice is proof enough of that. Maybe your Simon has seen the light, but he draws his power from Valinor. He is no true traveler. I would distrust him for that alone."
Farin tightened another strap, pinching Alan's side so hard that he slapped the armorer's hand away. Master Farin bowed and murmured his apologies, returning to his work with assurances that it wouldn't happen again. Alan turned his mind back to the conversation.
"What do you mean? Simon's a traveler."
Grandmaster Naraka adjusted her red glasses.
"The original 9 territories, including Ragnaros, have existed since the beginning of time. They encompass all the powers of nature. Over 1,000 years ago, we were granted access to Elysia, the 10th territory, which represented the enlightened virtues of man. For centuries, the world existed in balance, until the first Damascan queen eradicated the Elysian travelers. But that is another story. Valinhall, in contrast, has only existed for 60 years. As far as we have been able to learn, the territory was cobbled together in one of Damascus's twisted experiments. Damascus undoubtedly intended to use its power to further pervert the natural order, but the first Valinhall traveler, by the name of Valin, turned the territory's power against Damascus. In the ensuing conflict, most of the Valinhall travelers were killed. Only a handful remain, a rare and dying breed."
Grandmaster Naraka's voice drifted away, and she stared past Alan as though she saw the distant past in her dark red lenses. Alan stood still as Master Farin moved over him, still tightening straps and adjusting buckles. How did someone make a territory? For that matter, where did the other territories come from? More importantly, he failed to see what any of that had to do with Simon.
"That sounds even better," Alan said. "The Valinhall travelers hate Damascus too, don't they? They're on our side."
Sadly, Grandmaster Naraka shook her head.
"I wish that were true, but the enemy of our enemy is not always a friend. Valinhall travelers cannot be trusted."
"Why not?" Alan asked.
"They are no true travelers," Naraka said in a tone of disgust. "Their territory was created, not born. It's a twisted abomination. Their only purpose is to kill real travelers, like they killed my granddaughter."
Master Farin cleared his throat and focused pointedly on Alan's left boot.
"I'm sorry to hear that," Alan said carefully.
"It was 8 years ago, just before midsummer," the Grandmaster began.
Her voice softened as she spoke, and she almost seemed to relax.
"My granddaughter, who was also a Naraka traveler, went with a partner to the Latari Forest. You have heard of the place?"
"Yes, of course.
Alan said. He had grown up hearing stories of Latari Forest all his life. It was only a day or two from Myria. I heard that's where Simon's father died.
Naraka sighed. Another victim of the Valenhall Travelers, no doubt. Truly unfortunate that he chose to side with them. Anyway, we learned that Damaska had sealed a very powerful force at the center of Latari Forest. It is to maintain this seal that the Damascans sacrifice 9 lives every year. We thought that if we destroyed the Damascan prison and set this power free, we might be able to stop the sacrifice. My granddaughter and her partner were one of the 12 teams we sent.
Master Farin clapped Alan lightly on the shoulder, signaling that he was done, and bowed one more time before slipping from the room. Alan didn't blame him. He wouldn't have wanted to eavesdrop on such a personal story either.
Alas, there were Valenhall travelers guarding the Latari Forest, and they sided with Damaska. All 24 of our travelers were killed, including my granddaughter. We would never have known what happened, except that a few managed to send messengers back through their territories before they died. If Valenhall had joined us, rather than the Damascans, perhaps Zachareth's rule would be over even now.
One detail of the story bothered Alan. How many Valenhall travelers were there? Alan asked. They killed 24 of your people, but I thought you said Valenhall travelers were rare. Grandmaster Naraka turned her red lenses on him.
Perhaps only one.
Alan would have been significantly less stunned if she had punched him in the face. One traveler had killed 24 others? He had seen what some of the Enosh travelers could do, and he couldn't imagine standing alone against such power. His thoughts turned to Simon, who had survived a great battle involving over a dozen Damascan travelers from at least 2 or 3 different territories. Now, the carnage in that canyon took on a startling new aspect. When Alan had seen the remains of Simon's battle, he had assumed that Simon had called up allies to help him fight the Damascans, and had eventually managed to either survive the conflict or slip away in the confusion. Had Simon actually managed to win that fight alone? Alan's respect for Simon sharply rose. If Grandmaster Naraka had meant to tell him that story to stop him from relying on Simon, she had failed dramatically. He trusted Simon's dedication, and if Simon was worth a dozen enemy travelers in combat, Alan had to secure his help. "You've given me a lot to think about," Alan said at last. Grandmaster Naraka nodded.
"Think on what I've said. In the meantime, let us turn our talk to happier matters. I have a surprise for you."
She even smiled, which looked unnatural on her gnarled face. Naraka walked over to the doors and pulled one open. Either those doors were balanced perfectly, or she had much more strength in her body than it seemed, because at her touch the door swung open easily.
"Come on in," Grandmaster Naraka called.
Alan's sisters walked inside. Once again, Leah entered the Enosh Grandmaster's palace through a dusty broom closet. The tiny closet would have barely had enough room for 2 people standing side by side if it was empty. And as it was, Leah was nearly crowded out by mops, buckets, brooms, rags, and discarded furniture. Uncomfortable as it was, this was the only out-of-the-way place where she could figure out how to open a Lyrial gate. Traveling from Lyrial required her to perform complex calculations based on the movements of the territory's 12 shifting moons. Landing where she wanted was like trying to put a ball through a hoop, only the hoop was tied to the back of a wild horse, and there were 12 horses, each with a hoop, but only one was the hoop she wanted. It was enough to make her want to tear her hair out at the roots. Luckily, she had mastered the trick to putting a gate in this one old closet. If only she could have found somewhere a little less dusty. Leah let the gate vanish behind her, taking with it the clean, cold scent of Lyrial. She adjusted her skirts, peasant brown again, the same as she had worn for the past 2 years in the village of Myria, and stepped through the closet door. As soon as she stepped through the door, she sneezed, and of course there was someone there to see her. A servant stood in the hall, rag and bucket in one hand, his other reaching out for the door handle. He stared at her for a moment, as if he had seen her pop out of thin air, and then he stared suspiciously into the closet, as though looking for someone else.
Leah delicately dabbed at her nose with her handkerchief, then folded the cloth and put it in her pocket. She met the servant's eyes and arched one eyebrow. He opened his mouth to say something, but she kept staring at him. He eventually shook his head and walked away from the broom closet, while she walked calmly away. She allowed herself a small smile at that. In Enosh, or the capital city of Cana, servants were all the same. As Leah walked the halls, she lost her purposeful stride, stopped pinning people to the walls with her stare, and choked back her impulse to command the servants out of her way. In short, she became once again the villager Leah, daughter of Kelia. That was what they would call her in Myria. In Damascus, she would be Heiress Leah. The common folk would address her as Heiress, Heiress Leah, or Highness, but to those of equal rank, she was simply Leah. Her family had no surname, since any family that held the throne was required to sacrifice their hereditary name as a symbol of their dedication to Damascus. The policy had played its part in stopping more than one civil war over the past 3.5 centuries, but Leah liked the way the villagers did things. Her mother, Kelia, deserved to be remembered. Leah froze at the intersection of two hallways, trying to remember which way led back to her room. The Grandmaster's palace was enormous, perhaps even as big as the Damascan royal palace in Cana, but she had not yet had time to become familiar with its layout. She stood still for a good 20 seconds, trying to pretend she was exactly where she wanted to be, before she realized she could openly ask. Any number of people passed her in the halls, servants, travelers, ordinary citizens, and most of them would probably know how to direct her. She had become too used to the way things were done in Cana, where she had to project invulnerability at all times, or else invite an attack from one of her siblings or enemies. Leah, daughter of Kelia, had no enemies. She could ask directions from anyone she wanted. Sometimes Leah enjoyed being a villager. She felt so free. Once she secured directions to her room from a passing maid, Leah turned her mind to her mission. As she walked, she took stock of her situation. From her father, she had two goals: maintain surveillance on Alan, the Elysian traveler, and gather as much information as possible on the Grandmaster's war plans. She could keep an eye on Alan easily enough, as Alan himself would likely tell her anything she wanted to know. The Grandmasters were a more difficult matter. In Damascus, Lyria was a relatively rare territory, due to a somewhat stormy history between Lyrial travelers in general and the Damascan throne. As a result, she had already encountered more Lyrial travelers in Enosh than she had ever met in Cana. She would therefore have to exercise extra care if she meant to use her Lyrial powers to spy on the Grandmasters. If she were detected and unveiled as a traveler, she would have some awkward questions to answer. But those two tasks were possible enough. Worse were the duties she had set for herself. First, she had to keep an eye on Simon, not just Alan. From what she had seen and from what Indiriel had said, he might be just as important to coming events as Alan. If she played her hand right, she might even be able to tell him that Enosh travelers, not Damascans, had killed his father. That could be enough to win her a valuable ally. Second, she could not let Talos ascend to the throne. King Zachareth had yet to name one of his children's successor, so she still had time. But with Edessa's exile, only Talos and Leah herself remained as likely choices. Leah had very little desire to rise to the throne herself. Too many responsibilities, too much blame. But she was prepared to do her duty to the people. And it had begun to look like her duty to the people meant stopping Talos from attaining the throne. Before she had moved to Myria for her 2-year trial, Leah had known her older brother as a level-headed, if ruthless, rival. In the last few weeks, Talos had seemed unstable, almost unhinged. Sometimes, he seemed almost desperate to overthrow their father, but he spoke of the throne as if he didn't want it. So with a war against Enosh looming on the horizon, Leah had nothing more to do than monitor a prophesied hero, supervise a deadly young traveler, spy on the enemy, and prevent a royal coup. Leah hoped the city of Enosh had a well-stocked library. She wouldn't want to get bored. Since the plague that had taken Alan's parents, his 3 sisters had all but raised him. Tamara, the oldest, entered the room first, following Grandmaster Naraka's call. "You honor us, Grandmaster," Tamara said warmly,
This hospitality is more than we deserve.
She bowed at the waist, holding her long hair up so that it did not sweep the floor. She always was proud of her hair. Grandmaster Naraka turned her own smile on Tamara, and Alan was half surprised that Tamara didn't flinch and turn away. The Grandmaster's smile looked like it belonged on a bat.
"It is your brother who honors us, child."
Tamara looked at Alan, and her eyes sparkled with amusement. "Oh, I'm sure he's an honor," she said. Shai, 14 years old, was Alan's youngest sister. She said nothing, simply bowing to Grandmaster Naraka and slipping off to the side. Shai rarely said much, and today she seemed bored, her flat eyes staring at everything without a spark of interest. But Alan knew her better than that, so he kept an eye on her. Ilana bowed as she entered the room, but she flashed Alan a grin. At 20, she was 3 years older than Alan, and still unmarried. He hadn't seen her since the night of Malachi's raid on Myria, when a squad of Damascan soldiers had cut her betrothed down as he ran. He would have expected to see the shadow of that tragedy on her face, in tightness around the eyes or a hollow smile, but she seemed her usual self.
"Do you have nothing to say to your sisters?" Grandmaster Naraka asked.
In truth, Alan had been too stunned to speak. He had sent travelers to Myria months ago, shortly after he arrived in Enosh, to make sure his sisters were safe and cared for. Since then, he had barely thought of them. He felt a little guilty about that, but events had proceeded so fast that he had barely had time to think at all. Alan thought his smile would split his face in half. He had never thought it would feel so good to see his family.
"Ilana, Tamara, you look wonderful. I'm so glad to see you've been keeping well."
He would have mentioned Shai as well, but he thought she would probably be happier if he didn't draw attention to her sneaking along the back wall. Ilana and Tamara sighed together.
"Listen to him," Tamara said.
"He sounds like he's making a speech," Ilana added.
"Keeping well? Why, yes, my good sir, we have been keeping well. We spend so much time knitting and attending balls that we hardly have time for tea and scones."
The three women, Grandmaster Naraka included, all laughed. Shai continued creeping around, seemingly on a quest to see and touch as much of Enosh as she could. Alana's good-natured mocking did not put a dent in his smile. If anything, Alan felt relieved. After her promised husband's death, Alan had been afraid that her sense of humor would never recover.
All right," Alan said. "I'm so glad to see you."
He spread his arms and walked over for a hug. He clanked as he walked, which gave his sisters the opportunity to poke fun at his armor. But he didn't mind. Much. Behind Grandmaster Naraka's back, and safely out of Tamara's sight, Shai pulled a clock down from a shelf on the wall. She sat down with the clock in her lap and began taking it apart. After they spent a few minutes catching up, their conversation naturally turned to Alan's newfound powers.
"Are you the one teaching Alan to travel, Grandmaster?" Ilana asked.
"I am," Grandmaster Naraka replied.
"How's it going?"
Naraka shrugged.
"I have had worse students, and I have never taught an Elysian traveler before. But I suspect we would make more progress if he did not think so much of his own abilities. He seems to think he is invincible."
Alan's face heated, and he raised one gauntleted hand to his mouth as if to cover a cough. Maybe Ilana wouldn't notice his blush. Tamara chuckled quietly at the Grandmaster's words, but Ilana nodded.
"You praise him too much," she said. "It goes straight to his head. If you don't prick his ego every once in a while, it'll just keep swelling."
Even Shai piped up.
"Too proud," she submitted, from the floor next to her pile of clockwork.
It was hard to tell behind Grandmaster Naraka's dark red glasses and her mask of wrinkles, but Alan thought she was trying to restrain a laugh.
"I will defer to your wisdom in this matter," she said, "but I'm afraid it may be too late. Our next meeting together will not be until after the citywide celebration in his honor."
Ilana sighed and shook her head sadly. "Oh, no. There will be no talking to him after that." At that point, Alan thought it was his place to speak up.
"The city is celebrating, Ilana, because I defeated one of the overlords. Malachi lies dead because of me."
Alana's eyes went flat and hard, and a shadow entered her voice.
"Good.
His men killed Aiden.
Tamara put a comforting arm around Alana's shoulders, and Grandmaster Naraka glared at Alan as though he had done something wrong.
You snuck off against our advice, the Grandmaster said. You risked your life, the life of one of our most promising young travelers, and the fate of this city on your own whim. The fact that one good thing came of your decision does not justify your actions.
Alan started to speak, to defend himself one more time, but Grandmaster Naraka cut him off.
That reminds me, she said. We have a strategy meeting after you address the city. We need to discuss our actions against Damasca.
Alan glanced at his sisters. What about them?
Don't worry about us, Tamara said. The Grandmaster has given us wonderful rooms. We'll be here when you get back.
There's a clock in my room, Shai called.
Alana smiled, though there was still a touch of darkness in it.
I'm sure it won't last long, Shai.
Tamara noticed the pile of gears and springs surrounding her sister for the first time, and immediately launched into a combination of apologizing to Grandmaster Naraka and scolding Shai. Her face remained pleasant enough through the whole tirade. Alan's sisters left the room, and the Grandmaster moved to follow them.
I won't Simon at this meeting, Grandmaster, Alan said.
Naraka stopped. She half turned to face him, her glasses gleaming red in the afternoon sunlight.
That is not wise.
In his mind, Alan reached out to the golden power of Elysia, like a warm sun just over his shoulder. Somewhere, an acorn in a golden cage began to shake.
I wasn't asking your permission. It's already done.
Grandmaster Naraka's answering bow was nothing more than a fractional nod of her head.
As you wish, Eliadel. Now come. The people await you.
Alan walked out with her. The door slammed shut behind them, the sound echoing loud and hollow in the empty halls.
Chapter 6. The Grandmaster's Council. Simon's gate opened on the last place he'd left, his suite of rooms in Enosh. After his final showdown with the Damascan travelers, he had traveled to Valenhall for healing, but he'd been forced to take three of Alan's huge Elysian bears with him. Valenhall, he had learned, was not equipped to support bears. They had torn up three couches and one of the strange oxen from the garden before the Nye had enough. Simon had walked the bears from the canyon at the edge of the Bedari Desert all the way back to Enosh, and had managed to sneak them into Alan's room. That had taken most of a day, but the look on Alan's face when he saw the bears was worth every second. Simon had spied on Alan's reaction from outside his window, and after seeing the bears, it had taken Alan all of 10 seconds to summon a tracker that located Simon. After that, Alan had insisted that Simon be given rooms in the Grandmaster's palace, and the little buzzing acorn alarm that would alert him in an emergency. Alan hadn't put it quite that way. He said something like, "Now I can call you whenever I need you." But since it would allow Simon to help in case of an attack, he let Alan's poor phrasing slide. The rooms here were no better appointed than his bedroom in Valenhall, though he had much more floor space here. For some reason, his bed and washstand were 15 paces apart. Did they expect him to host a dance party in his bedroom? Rich people, he thought, with a mental shake of his head. He stepped out of the room and almost ran into Leah. She looked as startled as he was, her blue eyes wide.
Simon, she said, I thought you were...
gone. For some reason, she jerked her wrist behind her back, as though she meant to hide the crystal bracelet she always wore. After a second, she relaxed.
I was in my territory, Simon said carefully. He found himself watching his words with Leah after rescuing her from Malachi's tower.
Oh, really? Leah didn't sound intrigued or frightened or in awe, any of which Simon would have expected from her when talking about his traveler powers. She sounded like she was thinking about something else, like his answer had been expected.
Simon, Leah said, I've been meaning to talk to you about something. Do you have a minute?
Without waiting for his response, she grabbed him by the arm and pulled him to the side of the hall, where they would be out of the irregular hallway traffic. He considered telling her that Alan had called him on some urgent business, but he found that the idea of making Alan wait didn't bother him at all. Besides, If you discounted his recent suspicions about her, there was something exciting about having a pretty girl, having Leah, pull him aside for a private conversation. He made sure to keep his face blank as he let her draw him toward the wall. He wasn't Alan, to gloat over something this small. She stood distractingly close so that he could feel the heat from her body. "Simon," she said, "how did you become a Vallenhall traveler?" Simon blinked. This was not at all where he had expected, or hoped, this conversation would go. After what happened, I wanted to find a way to fight travelers. So I found a Vallenhall traveler, and I convinced him... How? Leah interrupted. He wasn't quite sure what she was looking for. I begged him, mostly. I'm not entirely sure why he agreed, to tell you the truth. Leah waved that aside. No, I mean, how did you find a Vallenhall traveler? Even if I wanted to, I wouldn't know how to go about finding one. Other than you, but you know what I mean. The direction of her questions was becoming clear, but Simon still wasn't sure why she was asking. Besides, he didn't want to talk about the night his father had died. Then again, Leah had been captured by the Indros traveler, Cormac, and left in Overlord Malachi's hands for weeks. Somehow, he felt that she deserved to know the story. "Do you know what happened to my parents?" Simon asked. She shook her head, and her blue eyes focused on him as though she meant to memorize his every word. "We were making a delivery through Latari Forest," he said. "I was a kid. We ran into two travelers, and they attacked us. They killed my father pretty much immediately." He skimped over the details to spare both of them. This was nothing he wanted to relive. "Vallenhall travelers?" Leah asked. She sounded confused. "No, just regular travelers. One of them was Naraka, I think, and the other one summoned this glowing mist." "Asphodel," Leah said. Simon stared at her. She raised one eyebrow without changing the rest of her expression. "I've spent half my time talking to travelers since I got here," she said. "Not everybody locks themselves in their rooms. Keep going." He could accept that. It certainly sounded like the sort of explanation Leah would normally give, unashamed and commanding. My father died, and my mother, the Asphodel, I guess, fed her a bunch of mist. That's what broke her mind. Images floated up to the surface of Simon's mind, and he shivered. Leah put a sympathetic hand on his shoulder. "A Vallenhall traveler saved me," Simon went on. "I didn't know what he was at the time. I thought he was an incredible swordsman, good enough to take on travelers. When the attack on Myria ended, you were gone. Alan went off to save you, and I was left with nobody. I had to do something, so I decided to go find the only man I knew could fight travelers." Leah nodded along, clearly absorbing the information. "So you found him," she said. "Not him, but another one. He took me in." "What were the tests like?" Leah asked. "Tests?" Simon asked. Maybe she meant the way the Vallenhall rooms tested him. But no, there was no way she could know about that. "The compatibility tests," Leah said, as though it were obvious. "The travelers I've talked to here say that everyone has to pass a test to see if you're compatible with the territory. There's no way to know if you can travel otherwise." Something was going on with Leah. First, when he had seen her in Malachi's tower, she hadn't seemed like a prisoner. She had an explanation for that, and ordinarily he would accept it, but Malachi hadn't spoken of her like a hostage. If anything, he had suggested that she was holding him captive, which made no sense at all. Second, there was the way she was acting now. She had tried to hide her bracelet when she saw him, and she had worn that bracelet every day of the past.